T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It was definitely competitive.
Yeah. I mean,
it was, but it was a completely different industry then. It was film. It was studios. It was very classic cinema. Nothing like today where you can make a movie on your laptop.
Do you miss those days?
Part of it, I do, yeah. I mean, I've had some really great times over my life working with some major film directors on important films. So this film forum that we're doing here is 5 of the films that I've worked on in one capacity or another. Not all visual effects. I directed 2 of these films and wrote the original stories.
Which films did you direct on this?
I wrote and directed Silent Running with Bruce Dern. And it was a breakthrough film, and it really profoundly influenced George Lucas for Star Wars later on. And I wrote a lot of and directed Brainstorm with Natalie Wood and Chris Walken and Louise Fletcher and Cliff Robertson. And that was the movie that I was making when Natalie Wood had that tragic drowning accident.
Catalina. Yeah.
Yeah. From time to time.
But your job as the director, you have something else. It's not just about the money. You've got something else at stake here. This has been a passion because you have to know the script inside and out.
Right.
You put together the whole thing.
Right.
The process up until that point is quite detailed. It takes probably all of your attention, all of your effort up until that point. So it would not be easy for you to kill it. And it's even more beneficial for you to see these things succeed.
You want to see them succeed. And I think one of the things that I always try to bring to a movie, even when I'm working for someone else, like I'm working for Stanley Kubrick or Steven Spielberg or George Lucas or Ridley Scott or somebody like that, they're looking to me to bring something special to their movie that they don't know how to do. This is a very interesting part of my career, which is that I get brought in. Because they say, oh, Doug, you did the visual effects for 2001. What can you do for me? I say, well, I can do a lot for you, and I'd like to help you make your movie be even better than you imagined. So that's kind of my job. I'm like a special surgeon who comes in to do some really tricky operation. And I made it my job to try to bring something unique to each of these movies I've worked on, which are part of this film forum. And I could give you endless examples. We could talk all day long, but... like in 2001, for instance, Kubrick had this vision of making this movie about a space adventure of going to another planet to try to track down the source of a signal that's being broadcast throughout the universe from an alien civilization. And we are we're following the bait, so to speak. And part of it includes a transition through time and space, which became what we now know as the Stargate sequence. And I had to figure out how to do that, and I felt a heavy responsibility because no one else on the movie could figure out how to do it. Stanley Kubrick didn't know how to do it. The production designer, the cinematographer, nobody knew what to do. And so that's the kind of job I love to do, is take on something that is just hair-raising for anybody else. Because I see the art of movies is a technological art form. You know, this is not like poetry or sculpting or something where you need to learn how to paint or draw or write. It's a technological art form, movies. And I like the technical side. My father was an engineer. My mother was an artist. And I just came with this like cool genetic code that seems to be very handy when you want to make movies, which are technological in nature. But they're aesthetic. They're beautiful. They're telling a story. There's emotion, there's drama, all the stuff that movies have to be, and I like to go like one step further. What's the common factor in these 5 movies we're showing here tomorrow that I brought something that made those movies different from the pack? And that's what I love to do.
Well, they're groundbreaking. I mean, 2001: A Space Odyssey is still remade. It's an iconic film.
Yeah.
So what kind of, you mentioned you're a technical kind of guy, but your dad was an engineer, your mother was an artist. You've merged these 2 things together. But when you're trying to figure out a problem that no one else has been able to solve, and you mentioned some names that are pretty renowned directors and movie makers, filmmakers, who are pretty smart guys, they can't figure it out. what enables you to go beyond that? Is it a diving into some type of scientific theory? I mean, how do you figure these things out?
It's this kind of weird skill I've developed over the years, and it has to do with bringing together the kind of best of art and visual ideas. Because I can draw, I can paint. I used to be an artist, a professional illustrator. And I can also think story, and I can also think mechanics and electronics and optics, which comes in really handy because I can come at a problem from a different direction that most people would do. Like, for instance, in today's movie industry, computer graphics is the way to go. Mm-hmm. It's the global standard of solving problems is computer graphics. And I see computer graphics as frustrating for me personally because it's not the smell of grease paint. It's not tactile. It's not physical. It's all numbers and algorithms. You know, you build something as a model that's a bunch of what we call a wireframe model of geometry of a shape of a building or a car or a person or whatever. And then you have to do texture maps. And then you have to do shaders. And you have to do all this other stuff. I said, you know, that's not for me. It's just not satisfying for me creatively and physically.
Yeah.
So I try to say, oh, let's just look at it from a completely different perspective.
Yeah.
How do you do something that would satisfy the needs of the movie, something be really spectacularly beautiful and unexpected and go beyond what the writer wrote? And that's what I like to bring to movies.
I also miss that kind of tactile. I remember I was on, I think it was at Paramount Studios, wherever they filmed Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
And they're building the set for Hunt for Red October. I think it was Paramount.
Yeah, it was.
And they were building it. This is before it came out. This is a new movie called Hunt for Red October. And I don't know how often you would know more than I would, but how often they still do those elaborate set buildings mm-hmm. that they do nowadays. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, my wife and I watched a movie yesterday from the early 90s. It was even the early 90s were so much different than today. There was time. There was patience. There was storyline development right. of characters a lot more than today. It's so fast paced. Do you miss that older style?
Yeah, I do.
Of filmmaking that really it requires the audience to think a little bit more than it does today.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's happened that I'm watching, and I don't know the answer to this conundrum, but it is the relationship between movies and television. Because technologically, there's almost no difference.
Yeah.
The technical standards of movies and the technical standards of television are almost identical. And so you get this kind of gray area, and you ask yourself, well, what is a movie mm-hmm. on a movie screen in a theater versus the same movie on your television or your smartphone or your tablet? And part of that is that the television medium is very stimulating, but it's very limited. It's like a filter only certain things can pass through a television set. You know, the epic grandeur of a spectacular exterior desert scene in Lawrence of Arabia doesn't come through your TV screen very well.
Right.
But when David Lean was making that movie, he knew he had 70 millimeter and giant screens and big theaters, and he wanted to make an epic experience. And other directors have done similar things. Stanley Kubrick did it for 2001. Around the World in 80 Days. And then that whole era of 70 millimeter epics, what we call roadshow movies of Sound of Music, West Side Story, you know, there were often adaptations of Broadway shows, musicals, really worked well in 70 millimeter because the medium could like carry the live performance nature of a live show.
Yeah.
And it's gone now. 70 millimeters. DOA. And so we have digital cameras, digital projectors, and digital TV sets, and an industry that's now drifting inevitably more and more in that direction. And that's being confused, I guess, to a certain degree by streaming.
Yeah.
Of just bulk commoditized production of content at the lowest possible cost in the highest possible volume to create a subscriber base for a business model that somebody thought up.
Yeah.
That's not cinema to me. That's just grinding it out. That's grinding out content. That's not the passion that filmmakers and studios used to feel in the 40s and 50s when they were really in the heyday of making Casablanca or any of the great movies you can think of. People are not thinking that way
anymore. No, it's sad. I mean, a good filmmaker, and you know when you walk away and you've seen a really good movie, you're thinking about it for a couple of days afterwards. That's what happens to me.
Yeah.
I think about the plot and some things come to my head, and I'm not a film buff. I've watched movies my whole life. But I know people who work in the industry, but I understand when something is it's moving, it's very creative, it's intelligently written,
yes,
and acted and directed. And I think Ryan Johnson is one of these guys, if you know him, he just came out with a movie called Knives Out.
Yeah, right.
And he did Looper before that. He did one of these Star Wars films too that just came out, The Last Jedi, I think. I knew him before he got in the film industry. Mm-hmm. I thought, good luck. That's a tough industry. He just, because he's so brilliant. He's smart. And he's one of those filmmakers that I think that we sure could use a lot more of. And I guess companies that would take the time and the investment to really give people like that and like you the opportunity to make more movies like that. Would 2001, knowing the audience today, or any of these movies really, Close Encounters, Brainstorms, Silent Running, Star Trek, those original ones way back then, would they play well today? I know we're going to see them again. What are you expecting from the audience starting this weekend when these movies are being shown? $1 a piece, by the way, is a great price.
It's a good
deal.
But
what do you think they, first of all, who's the demographic that you think is going to show up? And secondly, would someone who doesn't maybe fall into that demographic be entertained with the expectations of today?
Well, there's several answers to what you're asking, but I'm really fortunate to be in the presence of Corey Jacobson and Phoenix Theaters here, which is quite an unusual exhibition company that really is extremely family-friendly, price-sensitive, quality-conscious, and really want to do a great job in a theater to satisfy their audience's, you know, desire for a spectacular experience that you can't get on your TV set. That's what movies in theaters are all about. And I really admire that. And that's why I'm here, because this guy is so special and this company is so special and unique. And so inviting people today who have maybe never seen these films or maybe even never even heard of them or maybe saw them on television and weren't impressed because the concept behind the movies was so epic that it doesn't pass through that filter of television as successfully as it will on a screen. So here we are, making it easy for you to bring your whole family, $1 a ticket, come and hang out, look at these movies, and see what a giant screen epic kind of movie experience can be. That's what I'm all about.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to bring back the past. I think that's a waste of energy. But what I am trying to do is to say, well, what is the best of movies? What has happened in the history of cinema that's been really cool and really great? And have we lost sight of it? And is there a way to restore that and move forward in a better way than you would even imagine? Because we now have this incredible opportunity that's presented by digital technologies. Here we're in a studio. Look at all these monitors and keyboards and computers that are recording what we're saying. The technology we have at our disposal right now is so superior to anything we had with film. Okay? We're not stuck at 24 frames anymore. We're not stuck with 35 millimeter anymore. You can have any resolution, any frame rate, any screen size, any brightness, any bit depth, any quality you want on the screen can be done digitally now far better than throughout the entire history of movies. This is possible now. This is my jag right now. This is the mission that I'm on, is to try to say, well, if we could make a movie experience that's even bigger, brighter, better, more realistic or more involving or more immersive than anything you've ever seen before, how do you couple that with a story and performances by great actors and actresses, and a terrific director, and a great editor, and a production designer? How do you bring all the best together under one roof and take this whole thing to a new level? That's my mission.
Who's doing that right now?
I'm doing it.
Anyone
I'm
else?
I'm doing it by myself. No, there's bits and pieces of it around, because there are companies that are selling digital projectors to the movie industry. there are companies, you know, like Disney is a really good example of a very broad-based entertainment enterprise that is looking to increase audience attendance and more spectacle. And they have the unique attribute of Disneyland and Disney World. And they have one foot in this alternate world, which is these extremely powerful immersive experiences, which I'm fascinated by. Mm-hmm. And I had a really great time a few years ago when Steven Spielberg decided to make the Back to the Future ride for Universal Studios.
I know that ride, yeah.
And so here's Universal Studios making a big theme park in Orlando to compete with Disneyland and Disney World and actually doing a better job of it in many respects, because they had Jaws.
Yeah.
They had, you know, Close Encounters. They had
Psycho, I think. They had
all the Hitchcock library.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff was brought into Universal Studios that was kind of different from and kind of more edgy than Disney.
Yeah.
So I did the Back to the Future ride for Steven and Universal.
Wow.
And we had a ball. It was the most fun because it was adapting the trilogy of Back to the Future movies, you know, with Marty McFly and Doc Brown and all that stuff, and compressing it into 4 minutes of extremely high action and totally changing the nature of the relationship between the viewer and the movie. And the challenge that I was onto at that moment, and I'm still onto it today, is that instead of being a passive observer in a theater, you're sitting there in your seat, you're watching this movie, right? This is what movies are, mm-hmm. is a passive third person. You're an observer watching someone kill someone, chase someone, love someone, whatever a movie is about, but you're not in it. But in the Back to the Future ride, you're in it, and you're in Doc Brown's DeLorean car. It's on a flight simulator motion base, and the screen is so big that it completely envelops your field of view, and you're ripped out of your seat and thrown into the movie for 4 minutes of high action thrills with a story, with characters, and with drama and suspense, and a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a rousing conclusion in 3 minutes and 58 seconds. And this ride became one of the most successful theme park attractions in theme park history. And so I'm getting back to the Disney thing of, you know, them having a broad base of being involved in all these different media, television, theme parks, movies, streaming, everything. So they have a kind of a broader perspective of it. And that leads me to some other stuff that I'm really curious about. I don't have the answers, but we're now in this new era of episodic storytelling,
mm-hmm, yep.
of basically long-form storytelling that would take 6 hours in a movie theater.
Right.
Now you can see it in, you know, 6 1-hour episodes or 12 half-hour episodes.
Or you can binge watch it and watch it.
Or you can binge watch
it,
which I do. You know, yeah. It's really fun. Binge watching is a gas.
It is.
So we're in this kind of new, everything's different kind of thing.
Yeah.
And digital technologies make it all possible. And I'm an explorer. I like adventure. I don't like doing the same thing over and over and over. So
what are you working on now?
I'm trying to completely reevaluate what I think a movie can be. And part of that is to face the fact that the standard of movies, which is the frame rate of movies, which is based on the fundamental persistence of vision, okay? This goes way back to the Méliès and Lumière and all the people who invented movies and Edison and all the early days of cinema, was a technology based on projecting a whole bunch of still photographs so rapidly that it looks like motion. Okay? That's moving pictures.
Yeah.
And that's the core underlying thing. And that standard of 24 frames a second was set in 1927, and we're still stuck doing the same old, same old, same old. And I'm saying, well, I think we've got to rethink this. Why couldn't it be 28?
Why can't it be?
30?
I don't understand
it
that.
It can be.
TV is like 30, I think. And
well, TV is 60.
60, okay.
Yeah, so I'm saying, well, why can't we even go beyond that? So I'm actually in a kind of an experimental developmental stage of building a new entity, a new enterprise, a new kind of medium, which is 120 frames a second, 4K, 2D or 3D on a really big screen. That's bigger than Cinerama or 70 millimeter ever was in the best years. And doing it brighter, better, faster, and combining that with a good story and trying to say, well, you know, we could really kick this whole industry back into high gear because we could differentiate what the movie experience is in a theater from what you can get on television.
So you could either sit really far back, or you could have it surrounding you in a sense.
Yes.
Like in this, I would just think when you said that this room, and you could almost have a screen around you.
Yeah, you could wrap it all around you. You can be in the movie.
Yeah.
So it's possible now because we have the technology. I've got it working. It's called Magi. We're doing a little demo tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, tell me about Magi. Tell me about that.
Well, I started experimenting with digital photography and digital projection, and I was amazed to find out that there's an installed base of digital projectors all over the world that'll run at 144 frames a second. I was like, what? Really? How can this be? They said, well, we had to develop this high frame rate thing to enable digital 3D movies on screens. And I started looking to say, well, how does this work? And they said, well, all the movies are shot at 24 frames because that's the standard. But we show the left eye frames three times, and we show the right eye frames three times. So there's 72 flashes of left eye, 72 flashes of the right eye, and the projector has to run at 144 flashes of light.
Hmm.
And I said, well, holy moly, you mean it's already there and it works? And they said, well, yeah, sure, but nobody does it. So I started experimenting. Well, let's shoot at 120 or 144 frames a second and put it on that projector and see what happens. And man, it is amazing. It is totally amazing. So this is what I'm working on, is trying to find really the basis of a new art form that I think is going to be a rebirth of movies.
Hmm.
That you can't get on your smartphone or your tablet or your TV set or anything. It's going to go way over their heads. And that couples with what I call the installed base of talent. You look at the entire movie industry, the global movie industry of talented writers, producers, directors, cinematographers, editors. They're all really great, and they're super talented, and they do their very best every time they get a chance to make a movie. They do as best as they can, but they're being limited by the medium itself.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras are still kind of clunky, and 24 frames is just not enough. So that's my objective, is say, let's just break the mold and do something different, but harness the power and energy and creativity of all these people that are already really good, and just give them a bigger palette,
and they
give
all have
a bigger canvas,
and they have the creative juices. They want to probably do all these.
They
things
want
too.
To. They're dying to do it, and they're very frustrated. So if you talk to any of the current day directors that are really hot, J.J. Abrams or Iñárritu or Alfonso Cuarón or anybody, they'll all tell you they're very frustrated by 24 frames. And so, like Peter Jackson is a friend of mine. He made the Hobbit trilogy at 24 frames. Excuse me, he made the Lord of the Rings at 24 frames. He said, well, this is terrible. It's just not enough. You got to get the frame rate up in order for the 3D to look better. And so he did the Hobbit trilogy at 48 frames. He said, let's just double it and see what happens.
I didn't know that.
Well, he did it, and he hit a wall that was unexpected by him and by the industry, which was the assumption that it would be better, it would somehow get rid of the blurring and strobing of 24, but in fact it started looking more like television. It had a kind of what they call a soap opera effect.
Yeah. Why?
I'm going to give you
that?
The answer right here on radio, which is that for the 100-year history of movies, we've had film, okay? The film is a mechanical strip of celluloid running through a camera.
Yeah.
And in the camera, there are perforations on the film, and there's registration pins in the camera. And in order to advance the film from one frame to the next, the film has to be rapidly pulled to the next position for the next frame while the shutter is closed.
Mm-hmm.
The shutter has to close in order for the film to be advanced to the next frame.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's the fundamental underpinning of photography that's been with us forever, is that half the time the shutter is closed.
Yeah.
And whatever happened when the shutter was closed is missing forever. It's never going to be seen, captured. It's gone forever. And I realized that actually you could fix that problem by having another camera that's open while this camera's closed.
Oh, yeah.
And so now you can capture 100% of what happens. And what happens on the screen when you project that is that you see more. You never thought you would see more. Everybody assumes, well, you wouldn't possibly see more. It's all happening too fast. Who would notice? Well, you do notice.
Is it richer? Is that what you're seeing more of?
It's everything. It's richer. It's more. It's deeper. It's more involving. It's more physiologically stimulating. I've done tests. I've hooked people up to electrocardiogram, electroencephalogram, galvanic skin response, and metered people's physiological response to a movie based on frame rate changes. And I proved 30 years ago that if you get up to around 60 or more frames a second, people get much, much more excited.
Yeah.
Same story, same actors, same everything, same cameras, same lenses, but they get more excited.
Is a physical response to it?
Yeah.
So your
physiological response.
Physiological response. Yeah. You can technically maybe become addicted to films.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it'd be great for you. Almost like seeing someone in real life, though, is what you're, because I'm not blinking as fast as the, you know, shut it open.
Yeah, you can't.
Yeah. So, okay, that's fascinating. So will you be speaking about this tomorrow?
Yeah, I'm going to do a big master class tomorrow twice.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, it's kind of about what we're talking about right now.
Okay.
And I'm going to be talking about these five films and what is the common factor, what is the common thread between these films, and that's me, mm-hmm. and what is it about them that makes them stand out, which is that every film I've worked on except my first film, Silent Running, was a low-budget experimental film, was 35 millimeter. All the stuff I've done since then was 70 millimeter visual effects, even if the film was made in 35. We did the visual effects in 70 millimeter.
So you're always thinking ahead.
I'm always thinking ahead. I'm trying to stay ahead of the pack. It's a quality control thing that I learned from Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
How to make it really sharp, how to make it really clear, how to make it really in focus, how to perfect the quality of the image, because it's important.
Yeah.
And working with Corey and Phoenix Theaters is how do you make sure that that actually gets to the audience's eyes and isn't messed up by some low-budget lens or a crummy projector or a lousy screen or a dim bulb or any of the other things that can go wrong in the path. And Corey is a big quality control freak, as I am, and we try to make sure that everything that the movie filmmaker wanted gets to the audience without interruption.
Mm. And it's a frustrating experience. I'm sure the process of making sure that happens and you don't see it happen. But this is going to be fascinating. So you have panel discussions at 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. Then you have these master class lectures, 11 in the morning and then 5 p.m. This is at Phoenix Theater. This is in Monroe, correct?
Yeah, Mall of Monroe.
Mall of Monroe. What a great day that's going to be.
It's going to be a riot.
Yeah. And these movies, these films that you, I didn't realize when you handed this to me that you worked on every single one of these.
Yeah.
Out of these, what was your favorite? Sentimentally, which one do you like the most?
I still go back to 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
That was where I was a kid. I was 23 when I started working for Kubrick. And this was my film school. And I'm working with this genius master filmmaker, Stanley Kubrick, and it was so much fun. And he and I got along like buddies. I could do what he couldn't do, and he could do what I couldn't do. And that was kind of a marriage made in heaven. And that's some of the reasons why 2001 is so extraordinary, is it is so clear and so sharp and so thoughtful and so intelligent and brilliant. You know, Arthur Clarke wrote this story, and the whole idea of traveling through space and time, or the idea of the transformation of what it means to be a human, or a rebirth of a human being, which happens at the end of the movie, or artificial intelligence with HAL, you know, going awry and thinking it's smarter than we are. There's a lot of themes in that movie that are really strong and really well done and really well performed. But if you step back from 2001, if you've seen 2001,
oh yeah,
well, step back for a minute and say, well, is this great acting? Is this, who is this? And you say, well, maybe that's not the quality of the film that's making the difference. Is it great set construction? Well, maybe, maybe not. Is it great photography? Maybe, maybe not. And you have to ask yourself, well, there actually isn't much suspense going on here. And there isn't much of a plot. And there actually isn't much of a story or very much dialogue. And there are huge sequences in this movie with no dialogue at all and no characters at all. You say, well, what is carrying the day? What is it about this movie that's so unusual? And part of it is that Kubrick was determined, as a result of, you know, having this palette to work with, Cinerama, these giant 90-foot wide screens in specially equipped theaters around the world at the time, and 70 millimeter film and cameras. he felt a responsibility to deliver an experience that was going to be like being in space. Because he was thinking about this consciously 50 years ago. He said, I don't want to do this normal melodramatic storytelling plotted structure with people killing each other or chasing each other or whatever. I'm going to get all that stuff. I'm going to leave it all out. And I'm just going to go for the core of the visual experience because I want the audience to feel like they're in space.
And he captured it.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
And that is a lost art. Most people missed it, even in the day, until it got rebranded as the Ultimate Trip and people would smoke pot and go to the front row and watch the end sequence of 2001 because it was an experience. It wasn't just a story. It was an experience. So that profoundly changed me from that point forward. I've been on this jag for 50 years now since that movie was made, trying to claw my way back to that kind of immersive, spectacular filmmaking.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.